For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
All right, everybody. Well, welcome to a really cold, kind of miserable Colorado winter. And if it wasn't cold and miserable enough, we've had some adventures, some almost accidents, and a trip to Sweden. So today we're talking all about driving in the snow.
Yeah, we're going to talk about what cars are good in the snow and what things are good to have in the snow, like snow tires, which is obvious, and what things are not good in the snow.
So we're going to start with an ethical dilemma I had.
Yeah,
and a situation I do feel really bad about, but I don't know how much blame I can put on myself. So we got a lot of snow this past
I think the whole country got a lot of snow.
Yeah, this past weekend. It's been really bad. And I was driving down our main road in Boulder at about 28 miles an hour on a fairly snow-covered road, okay? And I was approaching a stoplight that had been green for a while and was yellow, significantly yellow, and then about to turn red.
Okay.
So I applied some brake pressure in our 2024 Jeep Wrangler with brand new KO2s. And I came to a stop, and there was a little bit of ABS intervention, but I didn't want to blow that red light. Behind me, traveling arguably too fast and too close, was a person in a new Hyundai Tucson. And it became pretty clear to me after I was about to stop that she wasn't going to stop. So I hit the gas and accelerated through the red light. And unfortunately, this person had veered off the roadway onto the sidewalk and took out a little tree. And nobody was injured. The car was still drivable, the front bumper was damaged, and the poor little tree was no more.
Okay.
The little tree died. So the question is, who is at fault? Do I have any fault because I came to a more abrupt stop than maybe I should have to follow the rules? Or is she at fault because she's going too fast and couldn't slow down in time?
I don't know if there's anybody at fault, but my rule of thumb is if there's snow on the ground, I'm just going to blow yellow. Because it's obvious that I won't be able to stop, and it's going to make it more dangerous for all around if I do try to do an emergency stop. And then you get into the situation that you're in where the person behind you is not expecting that because they think you're going to go through the yellow, and then they are fearful or are worried about hitting you, and bad things happen. So in the snow, I kind of think the rules change, and you just blow yellows.
Now, here's the challenge, though.
Yeah.
This was, and I think we might get the ticket, I'm pretty sure this was an intersection with a red light camera.
Okay.
So I blew a red light.
Yeah. That's all right. You know.
So that's going to be a ticket, right? And potentially, I mean, I could fight that and claim.
Yeah, I would say, hey, it was in the snow and I thought I couldn't stop. And so I did the prudent thing, and that was
But the problem is I did stop and then accelerated through the red light.
Well, you did the worst of both worlds.
Yeah. But, I mean, ultimately, you know, it probably was my fault. Like, I probably should have just blown that red light.
Yes.
But should that person who ended up hitting the tree have been going slower with more following distance and been able to make that stop
yes,
clear.
Yes, you should have been going slower with more following distance. But I'm just saying, for my years of driving, the rules change when it's snow covered and you know you're in the middle of an intersection and the right light turns. It's probably good just not to try to stop, but try to go
through the red light.
Yeah, because there's always some time before the other light turns green, so you do have some time to go through it.
The problem with blowing red lights, especially in the winter, is then you have an especially dangerous situation with cross traffic, you know, because there's also a shot they're not going to be able to stop if they would have to. So it's always a tough situation. I guess the moral of the story is I do agree with you. I think I probably should have run that light. And I'm sorry to that person who ended up hitting that little shrubbery and damaging your bumper. But at the same time, like, you can put yourself in a much more dangerous situation by going through a red light and having cross traffic come and slam you on the side.
Yeah, well, there's that saying, you know which rules are important and break the ones that aren't. And of course, that is all situational. Like, here's another one. We're probably going to get a ticket. We're driving back from picking me up at the airport, and there was an accident. And what we did was we crossed a double yellow line into the express lane, which means that it's going to be a $450 fine. But the reason we did that was to avoid the accident ahead of us. Now, in that situation, is the camera smart enough to know that there was an accident? Hell no. So I'm expecting a ticket for $400 to come in the mail because we did what was the prudent thing, which was get out of the lane where the accident was in.
And one of the challenges here is, like, with a typical traffic violation, you can go to court, right? And you can make your case in front of a jury of your peers or a judge or whatever. And there's a human factor of that person understands what you just went through. But so many of these new camera systems are fully automated. Right? So now you're making an argument to a computer, and maybe you're actually, your argument's read by a human at some point down the line, but it's a lot of paperwork, and they make it deliberately hard in some cases to fight these tickets. So,
And that's why we should fire as many employees as possible from the government, Tommy, and just computerize the whole thing.
That's right. So I want more AI interaction.
So that there's no humans involved, so that it's all just the machine saying, computer says no.
So one thing I do want to point out, though, is if that person behind me had snow tires, she would have been able to stop for sure.
Yeah, sure.
Because it was just a little slushy.
Yeah.
And part of the reason I was able to stop for that red light so quickly with no drama is because I had the new BF Goodrich KO3 tire, which is a snow three peak rated tire. And it really came to a stop quickly. My question for you is, I want to know what it was like driving around in the 70s before modern snow tires, when people were on bias ply tires in rear wheel drive land yachts.
Well, I wasn't driving around in the 70s, Tommy. I was
not 1870s, 1970s.
I wasn't driving around in the 70s.
Okay.
I was pretty young. All I remember is the sound of tires squealing on ice, because a lot of people were just always pushing their cars. There was just a lot of pushing, a lot of people would just start, and then there was a lot more snow back in the 1800s as opposed to now. And so there were massive snowstorms and people would just get stuck. The plows would plow you in, and then you had no chance of getting out except for being pushed out by your neighbors. So a lot of pushing out of people, a lot of tires spinning, and a lot of mayhem.
It is pretty amazing.
I mean, back then, the only all-wheel drive car. What were the only all-wheel drive cars in the 70s? Think about it.
Well, you had a lot of trucks. So,
trucks, yes.
F-250s, F-100s.
But most of those were rear-wheel drive.
But the K-10s, and then you had Blazers, right?
So trucks were the first vehicles to kind of go all-wheel drive, or four-wheel drive, I should say, en masse. But back then, most of them were rear-wheel drive. And in fact, they were worse in the snow because they had no weight over the rear wheels. And so people would stuff like sandbags to try to get traction. But many of the trucks back then were not all-wheel drive. Think about it, like, what's the first all-wheel drive Ford? It wasn't even Ford did it, right? It was an aftermarket company. Same thing with GM.
So in like the 50s and the 60s, there were companies that would convert your trucks. But by the 70s...
There were companies that would convert your trucks.
Yeah, but Ford did like highboys. Those were four-wheel drive from the factory.
Yeah.
I mean, you got the Chevy K10s and K20s. Dodge had a factory.
But those weren't the best sellers.
You also had back then, which was another challenge, is a lot of them were 8-foot beds. So going off your weight thing, that's a good point. So you had a huge amount of space behind you. But then, of course, you had like CJ5 Jeeps.
So that's what I was going to say. Really, the only cars that were good in the snow back then were Jeeps.
CJ7s.
Yeah,
Jeeps. But you also had Scouts, right?
Yeah, Scouts.
I was actually on the launch of the new International Harvester Scout.
Yeah.
Not International Harvester Scout.
Broncos.
Broncos, right? Yeah. The new one's just called the Scout, but I was talking to some Scout historians, and did you know something like 1 in 5 of every Scout that they sold was sold in Colorado? Did you know that? It was a huge percentage of Scouts were sold here in Colorado.
I mean, when I went to school at CU and came to check it out, this was in the early 80s, I wanted to rent an all-wheel drive car. What was the car? There was only one car that I could rent that was an all-wheel drive car.
Well, you probably had Audis, right?
Like 5,000s? You couldn't rent an Audi.
So maybe like an AMC Eagle?
Close.
It was not an AMC Eagle?
It was an AMC Eagle wagon.
Oh, okay. Well, that's an Eagle.
That was the only car you could rent that was quote-unquote. I think that was actually four-wheel drive, too.
It is a little baffling to me how long it took manufacturers four-wheel drive.
So what happened was all-wheel drive, and now I mean all-wheel drive, became a status symbol for luxury cars. And really, that's what brought it on. So like Audi, you said, they were one of the first to have all-wheel drive. And then just like heated seats or a steering wheel, this became a thing that people, even in states like Florida or California, where there's very little snow for the most part, wanted because it represented luxury and represented the next best thing.
But that, I feel like I wasn't around then, so I'm not the expert. But that feels like a pretty recent thing.
Yeah, because I'm saying in the 70s, there were just a lot of rear-wheel drive cars.
Well, there was a brand that had all-wheel, not all, but majority all-wheel drive.
Okay.
Subaru. So Subaru was one of the first brands in the 70s to introduce a four-wheel drive passenger car. And then throughout the 80s, you had the Loyale series. Which was...
Those 70 Subarus were slow and pitifully underpowered.
But they were good. They were all-wheel drive. Even as a kid, I remember in Boulder, you would see 80 Subarus.
Remember when we had
Subarus? Max? It's a great car.
How slow it
was. Yeah, it was slow.
Oh, my God. It was like 50 horsepower or something.
But they were so good in the snow.
Yeah, but then the rest of the time, they were underpowered and, you know, like made of tin.
But they're quirky. They're weird.
Yeah, so there were people, like I say, in Vermont and in Boulder and probably in like somewhere in Idaho, right, where they bought Subarus because of that. But in most places, the Subarus of that time were ugly, underpowered, quirky, and tiny. And these are not things that Americans were ready to buy in 1970.
But they were there. And they were there in the 80s when, like, Ford started putting all-wheel drive in some of their cars.
I mean,
and they were there in the 90s.
It became mainstream with, like, the big SUVs. That's when all-wheel drive, like the Bronco, right? That's the Chevy Blazer. This is how all-wheel drive became, I think, mainstream for the vast majority of people.
But that's a shame. What I'm surprised by is, like, you have Explorers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And S10 Blazers and Suburbans and Tahoes that were all, a lot of them were four-wheel drive, like your point. But it is a little shocking. It took companies such a long time to start applying all-wheel drive systems to normal passenger cars, especially when everything was passenger cars in the 80s.
Well, when you live in Florida, you don't need it.
Yeah,
but Texas, or
a lot of
half
people,
the United States.
There's a lot of people. I mean, especially the big three. They're in Michigan. They're based in Detroit.
Yeah, but what's the number one factor that drives car sales?
Price.
Yes. And so the second you add all-wheel drive or four-wheel drive, it's just going to make it more expensive. Mm. So why would you do that?
No, I understand. But it's like I just take it for such granted that everything is all-wheel drive. But the first all-wheel drive passenger car, I think, was the Jensen Interceptor FF. You know, way, way, way long ago.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then Subaru was an early pioneer. Audi was an early pioneer.
FF wasn't that long ago. You want to find it, Cole? Find the Jensen. Because I remember walking by the exotic car dealership and seeing one of those as a kid.
Oh, 66.
Yeah.
It's pretty old.
Yeah, they had one in the window.
But that was an example of that.
But that was kind of like an outlier, right?
Yes.
So they built that thing.
It was really small
and then
production.
And then it, you know, it was out there, but it never really like caught on. I mean, it probably took another three decades before most luxury cars even thought about putting all-wheel drive.
And then, of course, Toyota did some cool stuff, too, with, like, the Tercel.
We lost our lights.
Yeah, Cole will get them.
Okay.
Tercel, right, you could have with four-wheel drive.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, there were some cars, but I just think it's...
Tercel, there was the Honda Civic, station wagon.
Practically everything today is all-wheel drive, it seems like.
Or you can get it in all-wheel drive.
Yeah, exactly. But it really really was a key point. So you wanted to do a podcast here, which are, like, the key factors that make a car good or bad in snow. So what are some of your criteria?
Well, before we get to that, let me ask you this question, because I had an interesting conundrum happen yesterday, and I want like it's kind of like what happened to you. I want to know who if this was the fault of the other driver or if this was just something that happened. So I pulled into Sam's Club to get their fresh orange juice, which is really good, right? Mm-hmm. They have fresh squeezed orange juice, which I love. Anyway, so I pull in, and there was a truck that had backed in.
Okay.
And the problem was when he had backed in and I pulled in, now the driver's side doors face each other.
Sure.
So now we're looking at each other like who opens whose door first. Because
mm-hmm.
if I opened my door and he opened his door, we couldn't get into or out of our cars.
Yep.
So who is at fault here? Is it me pulling in nose first or is it him pulling in butt first?
Well, I don't think there's anyone at fault. I just think you ended up having to wait for someone. I mean, was anything damaged?
No, but we were like, kind of like, I was like, you go. And then he was like, no, you go. And I was like, no, you go. And I thought, I thought to myself, just pull a nose first, dude. Yeah, why are you backing in? Everybody else in the parking lot is nose first. And then then ironically, it happened again. So then I buy all my stuff, which is, you know, I'd been in Europe, so I bought a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And me and him show up at he had a Ram 1500. I had the Maverick at the trucks at the same time. And now we both want to put our stuff in on the driver's side as opposed to the passenger side.
Yep.
Because... you know, that's how it is easier to get out of there, right? When you go get the stuff out. And then we're both looking at each other like, who goes first? Because now I can't open my door, he can't open his door without hitting each other's doors.
I hate to say it.
Yeah.
Normally I'm against people backing into spots.
Yeah.
But I give passes, and I also back full-size trucks into spots. Because it's a lot easier to maneuver a full-size truck into a spot backwards than it is forward.
Why is that? You can't see where you're going.
No, but you're with the steering angle... I'm sure a physicist will explain this, but like pulling into the office here, there's a reason that Andre and all those guys back in is because pulling a full size truck in, it's hard to get that angle perpendicular.
Let's say I agree with that.
Okay.
Then the problem, and you have the same issue pulling out though, don't you? Right. It makes it easier pulling in, but then it makes it harder pulling out because that steering angle then reverses itself.
Yeah, but you're then going forward, so you have more control in my mind going forward. More visible, you have more visibility.
But wouldn't you have that pulling into a spot?
Yeah, but you need, here's what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Parallel parking.
Yeah.
You never parallel park start by going forward. No. You always parallel park going backwards.
Right.
It's the same kind of principle. You have more steering angle, it feels like, reversing into a spot.
You know what the solution is?
What?
Four-wheel steering.
Yeah, you could. Or a smaller vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah. So not much of a predicament, I have to say.
No, very much a predicament. We're both looking at each other like, who the hell goes first? Who gets out of their car or truck first?
And
who
puts their stuff
in first? Yeah, it was. I'm like, at that point, just pull in nose first, because then you've got this huge opening where you can swing your door open, and I could swing my door open, and every other car had pulled in nose first. He was the only dude who had backed into the space.
Oh, was he the only full-size truck?
No, come on. It's Colorado in Longmont with Sam's Club. It was all four-wheel. It was all trucks.
The thing is sometimes like full-size truck guys will squeeze themselves in there,
okay,
and then because they don't get that benefit of steering going backwards, they end up at an angle, and then it's just the whole thing's a mess. So I hate to say it, but I like to back in big vehicles. I actually think that's a...
It was a 1500. It wasn't like a 2500.
Big vehicle. In my mind, that's a large truck.
This is Sam's Club, Tommy. Those spaces are like triple XL wide.
Yes, right? That's true.
But even with triple XL wide, you can't open two doors at the same time.
Mm.
Especially the other problem then is the doors open at, you know, they don't open... They open, let me think, they open like this. So they hit each other. They don't, you know what I mean? You see what I'm saying? When one is backed up and one is forward, the doors open directly into each other.
Sure.
Like clack, right? Uh-huh. As opposed to like opening, like, you know, sideways, where you could potentially open up two doors.
I think it's a very rare situation, though.
Well, it happened
to
me.
Both people are getting out at the same time.
Yeah, we were both scratching our heads. All right.
Luckily, you're a smart guy, Dad. You figured it out.
So I was in Sweden. And I was driving the new Volvo EX30 on a frozen lake. And I ran into a little issue with the car.
Oh, look, they're zooming around behind you.
Yeah, I ran into a little issue with the car. And that is, you can sort of kind of turn the traction control off, but it doesn't allow you to really turn the traction control off. Mm. So the idea was to like go out there, and we had studded snow tires, to like drift the car around. But it was very hard to drift the car around because... The second that you got the steering wheel at more than like 10 degree angle, it would cut power. So one of the things that I think is important for, and this is just me maybe, for a good car that's good in the snow is control. And for that reason, see, so like right now I'm about to make a turn and you the back end comes out and all of a sudden you normally floor it and the back end will keep coming out. But you see how much I slow down? That's not me. That's the car cutting power.
Can you turn it off?
Nope.
Can you limit it?
That was it with the limited.
Wow, pretty aggressive.
Yeah, yeah, super aggressive. The one thing I would say that I'm going to make a blanket statement here. I don't think electric cars are good in the snow.
Wow, that's a bold statement.
Yeah, I'll give you three reasons. All right, number one, the battery sucks when it gets cold, so you lose range.
Okay.
And you lose significant amount of range, at least 25%.
Okay.
Number two, they're heavy. And so when you get the speed up and you get all this weight moving, all this mass moving, right? You're on a slippery surface. It's hard to control that. And number three, because they're electric, really they're computer controlled. And so you lose a lot of control, like in this car. Like in this car, I felt like the car was controlling me instead of me controlling the car. And I suppose on a normal road, in a normal icy situations, you would want this to happen, right? You would want the car to cut power if you were in an emergency situation. But then again, if you're a good driver, if you did have that power, you might be able to, you know, get out of an accident as opposed to like just having the car do whatever it wants to do and get into an accident. I don't know. I'm sure there are engineers who figure it out. All I can tell you is that in general, I don't like driving electric cars in the snow. And we've had a lot of experience with that, right? We've taken Rivians into the off-road in the snow. And what the electric car tends to do when stuff goes bad is it just cuts power on you.
Sure. I think a lot of what you're saying is right.
And it's also weird, right? Because you're like, hey, my foot is through the floorboard and yet there is no power going to the wheels.
I think that a lot of what you're saying is correct, yeah. And I do agree, especially with the weight thing. If there's an argument maybe that having some weight down low helps with acceleration. But in a lot of cases, it certainly does not help with stopping. And some of these EVs are very heavy.
Very, very, like the, I mean, very heavy.
Where I do like EVs a lot in the snow.
Yeah.
The range does take a hit. Yeah. 100%. And if you're road tripping an EV in the snow, bummer. But if you are commuting in the snow, one of the things I love about like our little Fiat is you can precondition the cabin with an app. You can do it while it's in a garage. Mm-hmm. Car's nice and toasty. You get out there. I actually have it on a schedule. 8:15 every morning. My wife gets to the Fiat. It's ready to go. Warmed up, he's good.
Yeah, you could do that in an internal combustion engine car too, right?
I don't know if, but the problem is, like, what if it's in a garage?
Then you don't want to start the engine.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. Bad.
Why would I want to waste that fuel and stick all that carbon in the air when I could just have it plugged in and just whoop, off you go, right?
So from a comfort standpoint, you're saying that they're more comfortable, but I'm saying from a handling standpoint, and from a usability standpoint, they're not as good as internal combustion engine cars.
There is another thing which I think is very cool.
Yeah.
Is that when you accelerate in an internal combustion car, right, and you're on a really low mu or a low traction situation, that engine is forced to cut power to maintain traction with the ground, right? And an internal combustion engine can do that. I don't know what the latest computer is, but it's something like 10 or 15 times a second. The traction control computer can make throttle adjustments. In an electric car, because you don't have to worry about torque curves and combustion, it can do it 100 times a second or 200 times a second. So one of the cool things I found with that Fiat is on really slow, really low traction situations, I'll floor it. And instead of the car feeling like it's fighting the ground, because the computer can make so many micro adjustments to power output so fast, you get a really smooth acceleration without like the... It's very linear. So I think that's very cool. There's a lot of really cool things you can do with the immediacy of EVs that you can't with gas.
Yeah, but in general, what you can't do is get wheel spin when you need wheel spin. And I'll give you an example of that. With the Rivian, we got stuck in pretty deep snow, and I was floored, and the computer said, right wheel has no traction, left wheel has no traction, rear wheel has no traction, rear left wheel has no traction, so we're going to give you nothing. And you're floored, and nothing's spinning. Or it's like, one spins, and then the brakes, you know, pop in, and the other one spins, and the brakes pop in. So you're in a situation where wheel spin could actually get you unstuck, but because of the way the computer is programmed, it's saying, no traction, no spinning wheels, which...
But-
which is bad.
I would argue that's less of a fault of the technology and more of a fault of the programming.
Yeah, but that's how all these cars are programmed. I'll give you an example. So this is a cross country, by the way, which gives you about 3/4 of an inch more ground clearance, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give you an example. So now I'm going around this corner, right? I've got the wheels pointing right.
Sure.
So there's maybe 20 degrees of lock. And normally what you could do is you could floor it and the back end will come around and you'd have this counter steer thing and you'd be having a lot of fun.
Sure.
So now I've got the wheels pointing right. The car isn't fighting any grip. So it's going directly straight for the snowbank. Even though wheels are pointing right, the car's going for the snowbank. Now, if I had actually control of the car, I could bring that tail around and then bring the tail around so that it's in the same direction as the wheel is pointing and then pull out of that turn. But because the computer says, no, I see that you're wanting to go right, but the car is going straight, I'm just going to cut all power. So you're just kind of,
yeah,
you know,
I know,
you're just kind of pushing straight into the snowbank. And yeah, that's what I mean. You don't have control. It's actually worse than that in some, because there's this illusion of control until you don't have control. And so I was talking to the driving instructor. I was saying, how do I get this thing to actually drift? Because drifting on ice is super easy.
Yeah.
Sure. Right? And there's usually no payment, no downside, because you just go off into the deeper snow and then they got to pull you out.
Yeah.
Especially here on a frozen lake, right? The snow that they had plow to the side hadn't frozen, so it wasn't hard.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the way you got to do it in this car is you got to go into a turn, make the turn,
yep,
and then once the steering wheel is straight, then you floor it, and that gives you power.
Mm.
Right? That's not the way you drift. That's just the way you drive.
Sure. I mean, I understand your frustration. And as a car enthusiast, I think everybody understands their frustration.
I'm not saying I didn't like the car. I'm not saying
no,
this is something that probably will save lives. I'm just saying, as technology keeps encroaching on everything we do,
yeah,
we're less drivers and more passengers.
No, for sure.
And that's sad.
No, you're right. But for someone like my mom, who has never cared about turning traction control off in her BMW iX,
right?
Like these are probably good safety things for her to have. And there's a lot of potential. Like I agree with you. I don't think I've ever felt an EV that lets you have all the fun when you want the fun. But I've also heard that like the Lucid Air Sapphire with the dual motor rear setup that can actively torque vector and apply power instead of cutting power to an outside wheel is supposed to be phenomenal. So I'd really like to try something like that's very, very well programmed for an enthusiast. So that could be really good. You know?
Yeah, I mean, Land Rover has done a really good job in creating an automatic terrain management system where it kind of knows what
mm-hmm.
situation you're on, and then it tends to allocate power. But in the more traditional all-wheel drive systems that aren't electric, right, where you don't have multiple motors, another good example or a bad example of that would be, remember our Hummer EV?
Mm-hmm.
Remember how great that was in off-road situations?
It was really bad.
It was really bad.
Yeah, it was really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and because once again, the computer took control instead of letting, you know, in a traditional all-wheel drive, let's say we got that G-Wagon that we had, right? You lock the center diff, you lock the front diff, you lock the rear diff, and then that big V8 sends 560 horsepower to all four wheels all the time, and that is ideal because now I know that all four wheels are spinning at all, and I know what to do with that. But in that Hummer situation, you've got an electronic diff, then you got a real diff, right? And then sometimes a real diff lock, sometimes a real diff doesn't lock. You don't know what the hell electronic diff is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes for, an off-roading situation where, once again, the car is trying to do what it thinks it should be doing. But sometimes you get a situation where it's not just not doing what you want to do, but it's counterproductive.
The thing is, like, I'm going to go back to this. I don't think that's a shortcoming of the EV technology, right? That's a shortcoming of programming and integration. Because if you were to get a Hummer, so we had the tri-motor with the e-rear diff, which honestly does nothing. It just spins and creaks and groans and does not work like a diff lock. But the front diff lock's mechanical works perfect.
When they lock.
Turns. Yeah, once I figured out the secret.
Keep in mind, we had the very first one.
Well,
and it's gotten much better over the years.
Yeah, you say that, but I just drove the newest one.
Yeah.
And it was really good in Moab on a high track situation.
Yeah.
But when I brought it out into our snowy off-road trail, it really didn't do well. Same kind of problem. However, it did do really well once I got that front mechanical locker to click on. Then it was awesome. So, like, the secret there with the Hummer, don't get the expensive one. Get the dual motor with the mechanical lockers. You're going to have an off-road beast.
Same thing with if you still want a Cybertruck.
Yeah, the dual motor
is better off-road than the...
So that's awesome, right? So
because a dual motor has two rear lockers as opposed to a tri-motor. An e-locker.
If you incorporate old-school mechanical technology and then implement it with modern-day EV goodness, you could have something really cool. I just feel like so many vehicles haven't figured that out yet.
So this is going off of your flip testing, right? The other forms, that the other cars that aren't good in the snow are a lot of Toyota products, and that is where there is no physical drive shaft between the internal combustion engine and the rear wheels. So oftentimes, especially on the new Toyotas, what you have, not on the 4Runner, of course, not on the seriously off-roady ones, but like on the Corolla or the Camry or the Prius, what you have is, or even a lot of Lexuses, right? What you have is you have an electric motor that runs the rear wheels, and then you have the gas motor that spins the front wheels. And in 90% of the situations, that's fine. You'll never even know the fact. But it's when you get into those very low traction situations that things start to go awry. And in the previous generation of Toyotas, it was actually worse than that, because the Prius and the Camry, that rear motor disengaged at above 25 miles an hour. So basically, when you were starting out, you would get all-wheel drive, and then after, I think, 25 miles an hour, the rear motor would stop pushing, so you were back to front-wheel drive, which is kind of weird.
Well, and so the first all-wheel drive Prius had a 7-horsepower rear motor. It was a little tiny guy.
Yeah.
And I think it was 40. I don't think it was 25.
Maybe it was 40. But anyway, it was at highway speeds, you would not be, you'd be rolling on two-wheel drive.
Now, to Toyota's credit, the e-all-wheel drive system they use in their hybrids has gotten substantially better. So when we first started slip testing the older gens, they really didn't have a lot of torque in the rear. And you could really feel that in how they performed in the snow. They drove like front-wheel drive cars, where they understeered like crazy, and you didn't feel like the rear axle was hardly doing anything at all. The new ones have gotten, like I said, better. They're happier to give you more initial bite, more initial torque. But I think you are correct, Dad, in that they're not as effective as a conventional drive shaft mechanical all-wheel drive system. And actually the Camry, Cole, if you click on that Camry video, that one, that's the old Camry. This is going to hurt my argument. The old Camry did better than the new Camry.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
So really? That was the one that's the exception. I found that, like, the RX, new ones are much better. The Crown was pretty good, but the Camry, the old Camry, was better on the slip test than the new one. And I think that's because, yes, I'm correct, this was a mechanical all-wheel drive system. So this is an example where they went from a drive shaft with the gas Camry to an e-hybrid system on the hybrid version, and it's not as good. That's what it was.
Yeah, I also, I'm really, oh my God, look at you, how short your hair
tiny,
was
tiny.
There. Yeah, your hair was so short.
I have glasses on there, too.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is, as we get, once again, going back to control, what are you breaking that for?
No, I want to show off this. Did you see this? This is my, if you're watching online, this is my Suzuki Jimny RC by a company called FMS. And we have it on the table because we're talking all-wheel drive. And these are hyper-realistic. I think this is a 12-scale RC with solid axles, and it's really cool. Locking diffs is awesome.
Another reason I think that modern cars are not as good in the snow is because they're all automatic. As every electric car is automatic, and I like having the control in the snow, especially of a manual transmission, because then it lets me use not just the brake, but potentially engine braking to slow the car down. And especially when I used to drive a lot of manual cars, now they're far and few in between. In the winter, I would try to stay off of the brake as much as possible and then try to use, especially back in the day when there was no ABS, right?
Right. Well, and like I think you're in a day before ABS, that's a good idea. Now I think that's more dangerous than using friction brakes. Because you can't, ABS is going to be able to maintain wheel speed equal to that of ground speed. where sticking it in second and then popping the clutch is going to
mess
up the...
Well, you don't pop the clutch. You just gently apply the clutch. Control.
I disagree. I think that the... I think manuals are worse than
the
snow.
All right. Well, let's talk about what happened with our ID Buzz. We're going to put that video out, but let's talk about... You know, you keep talking about how great computer control cars are. Why don't you tell them what happened with us in the ID Buzz?
Well, you're right. This is a good example where they take it too far. I don't think you're misunderstanding me. Computer control is not always better. But, like, would you rather have an ABS car in the snow or a non-ABS car?
Of course,
in the snow?
I'd rather have an ABS because you can't pump. You know, that's another fallacy, right? Where, I remember when I was going through driver's ed, they were like, and to get the best dropping distance, pump the brakes, right? Nobody can pump the brakes as quickly or as efficiently as the computer.
Right.
That's a case where the computer will just do a better job. 100%. Have you ever tried pumping the brakes for real? Well, it doesn't work.
And a computer can pump one brake faster than another brake or slower.
Yeah, that was just silliness.
This is dumb.
Yeah. Look, you're heading into an oncoming school bus.
Right.
Right. And you're going to pump the brakes.
So we just took this Bridgestone driving school.
Yeah.
And our video producer, Mary and Jen, just did the same thing. And I was talking to Mary, and she was telling me about this exercise that we did too, which is you go down a snow-covered icy hill, and then they turn ABS off in like a 4Runner, and you're supposed to threshold brake around a cone. And Mary was like, when would I realistically use that? And I'm like, Mary, if this was 1960, you'd be using it a lot. But never do that on a modern car. She drives a RAV4 with ABS. Don't do that. Just apply. So that was a really dumb exercise.
All right. Well, why don't you tell them what happened with the ID Buzz?
Well, the ID Buzz.
So we were doing a snow video. We wanted to see if it was any good in the snow. And we decided what we were going to do is take it down the big steep hill at the ranch and then see if it could make it up the big steep hill. And we had the idea, let's get to the steepest part and stop. And because if you have momentum, sure, it'll make it up the hill.
Right.
Once again, dual motor.
Electric,
big battery minivan. So this is not a car that you're going to be taking on an ice covered lake.
So on the hill, start up, really good traction, right?
Yeah.
Like, all right, I'll stop at the steeper part. We're talking like 15 degrees, snow covered hills, pretty steep hill. Go to accelerate, no traction, but the computer starts working. The front motor starts working independently from the rear. It's trying to find grip and it just can't do it. And then eventually I create like a little layer of ice underneath the tires.
Because they spin and then that polishes the snow into ice.
Yeah, and then the cars are sliding backwards.
Which is not good now because now you're sliding backwards into a fence.
But the car is also like, I think it's probably 6,000 pounds at ID Buzz.
Yeah,
it's heavy. Really heavy. So it's not going to stop. So what I try to do is like release brake pressure so that I'm not locking it up on the front wheels so I can get steer. And the computer just went into meltdown mode. Like it continued to grab onto the front discs, fully locked up, no control, just sliding down as a passenger.
And I'm like yelling at you, Tommy, straighten the wheel.
It doesn't, but the computer's saying no. The computer's locked up on the front brakes.
Let go of the brakes so you can actually steer the thing.
And basically, I was off the brake pedal or just super light pressure, but it had just clamped them. It was just...
And so now the wheels won't spin, so you have no control.
And I try letting off and accelerate as I slide down. The electric motors don't know what to do. So eventually I slide.
The cows ran away. They were so scared. At the bottom of the hill, the cows just took off.
I avoided the fence, made it down the hill. And I'm like, well, I got to do some momentum now. That was scary. Go to the accelerator. Nothing. Car was in drive. No warning lights, but it just like refused to move. The computer was like panicked. It didn't know what to do. It didn't know how to send torque anywhere. It just like full throttle, half throttle, didn't matter. Eventually I had to put the car in park, turn it on and off again, cycle the computer. And then it let me go. But yeah, that was like, we figured this out in the Maverick too. These computers, these traction control and stability control computers work really well. Slight sideways, even a lot of sideways you do well. What they hate is if you're sliding sideways and then end up spinning out. If the car starts moving backwards under any circumstance while you're trying to go forward, remember the Maverick was like, whoa,
yeah,
what the hell? And it threw all sorts of warning lights and problem lights and it panicked. Same thing with this ID Buzz. If you are trying to accelerate forward and the car starts sliding backwards, things go to hell. Which wouldn't happen in like your 1970 Wagoneer. You could just keep hammering on that 360 V8 and it would start moving.
Well, having said that, you almost ran into a Corolla because the Maverick does let you get the back end out.
Yeah,
so
it
tell
does.
What happened at the airport? How'd you
Another bad. This weekend was almost crashes. So this one was definitely my fault. I was very embarrassed by this. I was pulling right out onto a two-lane road, one in each direction, and it was a lot icier than I expected. So I'm going hard right from a stop, give it too much gas, and the rear end kicks out.
Man, which I did no weight back there.
I did not expect to that extent, but I'm like, it's okay, I can catch it.
So the car tries to go front wheel drive, nothing's happening, right? And it sends all the power to the back end.
So it sends a lot of power to the rear, woof, kicks the rear end out. I catch it, but as I'm catching it, a Corolla in the other lane starts making a left turn, and the rear end veers into that lane. So I caught it, but not fast enough. And thank goodness that Corolla was paying attention. It was able to kind of like steer out of the way.
So that was a case of the technology not working.
That was a driver error. Yeah. I was too aggressive on the throttle.
But that EX30 wouldn't let you do that.
There you go. So dumb car.
Yeah, it wouldn't let you.
I need a car for
kick that back end out like that.
I know. I need the car for the idiots. And that was I should have known that it probably would have come around. And I did catch it. I didn't spin out. But it was really scary because that Corolla was probably a few inches from. I should say I was probably a few inches from sideswiping that Corolla.
Yeah. So maybe the technology does have a good positive for sure benefit.
100%. And that was traction control on, stability on. Yeah. It was nothing.
How about like emergency braking? Have you ever been in a situation where the car decides, and this has happened to me more and more now. It used to be very rare. It happened to me like once. This is like maybe when emergency braking, what I'm talking about is when the car senses that there's something imminent in front of you that you're about to hit and you're not braking, the car will brake for you. Mm-hmm. So the first time it happened, there was a car in front of me that was making a left turn. And I wasn't paying attention. This is on me. And then the car just went into frontal emergency braking and it kept me from basically hitting the car, making the left turn in front of me. But more recently, I have seen and I have talked to people who have found that the vehicle goes into full emergency braking when there is nothing. Or it just happened to us. Remember with the Volkswagen ID Buzz when we were backing up and we were turning around in our field and there was some tall grass. And it decided that the tall grass was an object that we were going to hit. And all of a sudden, just full-on emergency braking.
Yeah, that was bad. I don't find on the road I get a lot of early interventions.
I'm seeing that more and more. Maybe as we get into more and more computerized cars, it's happening more and more to me.
I actually think it's the reason it might be happening more and more is because car companies are cheaping out. Mm. So Tesla, right, has a full vision ADAS system, meaning they don't use LiDAR.
Has their LiDAR and they don't use it.
Yeah, but any kind of proximity sensors, right? Yeah. They use a camera in the window, in the windshield. And I remember like the most phantom braking issues I've had have been on Teslas. Because that camera, especially in glare situations, can't differentiate an overpass from a brick wall. And I've had it, you've had this too a couple times, go full ert. But typically other brands that do use a proximity sensor instead of just a camera work really, really well. The bigger problem I have in the snow, which is just more of annoying than anything, and some cars give you heated elements on their sensors, but they get clogged up with snow, and then it just beep. It beeps.
Yeah, it happened on the Maverick. Yeah, it beeps, and then it tells you that some of the emergency systems aren't working, or some of the ADAS stuff isn't working, especially when it gets clogged up in the snow. And this is why level 5 autonomy is much further away than we thought, because it has to work in all conditions, right? You have to be able to go driverless with no driver under the worst conditions. And when the conditions turn bad, that's when all this stuff fails.
Now, the funny part about that is usually, like in the Maverick, it says, hey, automatic emergency braking unavailable. Right. And you're like, okay, cool. And it lets you go. I was driving the Fiat in the snow the other day, and the Fiat has sensors above the windshield, essentially, at the very top, and they got covered in snow, and I'm like, beep, beep, it's like, warning, this is unavailable. I'm like, okay, drive along, 30 seconds, beep, beep, this is unavailable. Okay, 30 seconds, beep, beep. Every 30 seconds, the car would tell me as many times as I had to physically pull over on the side of the road in an area where there wasn't a good pull-off. Because I was just going to go insane. It would not stop beeping at me. And then I had to grab my scraper and scrape the crud out of it. It's not a piece of technology I needed at that moment. It's not a piece of technology I wanted. And it would not let me turn it off. It just kept beeping like crazy. It was awful. It was like really bad.
Well, it's like, you're actually on your way to Sweden. I just got back from Sweden. So I was driving the XC90 on the road. Mm. It's got this thing where every time you exceed the speed limit, it beeps at you.
Yes, that's a new European regulation.
Yeah, but the Swedes have done something clever that is put it like one button. So all you have to do is hit one button. It's on the steering wheel and it turns it off. But then every time you cycle the car, in other words,
it turns on.
It turns back on. And to me, this is like government overreach.
That
right?
one it's for just, sure is, yeah.
It's just asinine because all you're doing is creating a system that everybody's going to turn off, and they're going to hate the fact that their car now beeps at them every time they cry. And
California then, wants to do that too.
You know what's funny?
Doesn't California want to implement that?
You know what was the funniest part? This is like, once again, when technology goes astray. You know, California, Newsom vetoed it.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, here's what, get this. So did you know, Tommy, that there's a speed limit on a lake?
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's 20 kilometers an hour.
Is that what the car determined?
That's what the car determined, yeah, because we were on a frozen lake, and the car determined that every time you exceeded 20 kilometers an hour, we are going too fast on a frozen lake.
That's dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really dumb. I heard, too, I don't know if this is true, I just heard it from another podcast, that the EU is also mandating that you can't have one button anymore to turn it off. Like, it has to be two layers deep to make it harder to incentivize people from turning off the speed limit warning. So that's just awful. That's a real problem. I remember the Ineos Grenadier that we owned had that. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Like, they didn't change the software. They finally did for the American market, but they didn't when we got ours. And it was the worst part about the car, because every time you went 1 mile an hour over the speed limit, it would start clicking at you, and then you had to go two menus deep to turn it off.
Yeah, it's why we sold it.
No, it's not why we sold it.
Yeah, it is. That's why we sold it.
That's why you want it. I love that thing. I would have pulled on to that.
That's why I sold it.
Yeah. That update was coming. No, you were just impatient.
Okay, I'm being funny here, but the reason I sold it was because of that.
It was going to be updated.
But what got to me is, if a car company can't figure out that this is one line of code that they can just basically like X out, right? If they're too like I don't know, unsophisticated to figure out that this is something that is not the law in America, and they let it run in America for a year before they actually disabled it, then I wonder about the rest of the company's engineering.
It's not fine.
It's like the most annoying thing, and they can't figure out.
Maybe how it's 500 lines of code, and if they missed that, if they messed it up, then they would take out the whole computer. Maybe there was like very well baked into the system.
Well, this was the heart of the system, maybe, right? The speed sensor.
Maybe
was
this
the
is
heart.
What the engine was designed around, as a speed sensor.
Heart of the but so let's go back to like what cars are good in the snow. So three things: ground clearance.
Sure.
Like I was just telling you before, you know that the Mach-E Rally, the off-road one, only has 5.5 inches of ground clearance.
This is my hot take of the day. Ground clearance, overrated.
Not in the snow, dude.
Even in the snow.
No, you turn your car into a giant snowplow and then you high center yourself.
And there is an argument that on back roads, you're right.
Yeah.
I have this Land Rover.
Yeah.
And when I got it, I put this like little lift on it. Really excited to use it in deep snow. Yeah. I'm like, now I'll be able to get over Loveland Pass in the deep snow, and all the little cars are high-centered. Anytime the snow gets deep enough to need ground clearance, road closed. The company, nope.
But there's that moment before they close it where all the cars are getting stuck.
One moment.
Where all the cars are getting stuck, where if you had that Land Rover, you would just plow right through. Because the reason they close it isn't because it's getting too slow. They close it because cars are getting stuck.
Sure. But the point, the result is the same. The result is the same. I can't get through that road then. So I think ground clearance a little overrated. I think you're right. 4 inches, not enough. 5 inches, not enough. Anything over 6.5, realistically, if it's over 6.5 inches of snow, you're probably not going to work or to school anyways, because that's a lot of snow. The roads are going to be closed, and it's going to be a mess, and things are going to get canceled. So if you want to go off-roading.
How about if you want to go to your winter cabin on a dirt road that hasn't been plowed here in
then
Colorado?
Yes, for sure.
A lot of roads aren't plowed.
But like I said, once again, that road to that winter cabin might be closed.
All right. So ground clearance, I think, is huge. Maybe
it's important, but it's not huge.
Okay. Why does your wife drive the Land Rover when the snow gets too deep? Why isn't she then trucking around in the Fiat?
Because the Fiat has bad tires.
Yes.
That's the number one thing if you're listening. Tires, the most important factor of any snow performance, tires. If you want to make your car better in the snow, don't go buy another car. Just go buy tires. It's going to change your world. I had a friend that just bought tires, and he said it was the most amazing thing when he went from a crummy all season to a Michelin snow tire. He said it was game-changing.
But this is another thing people don't do.
Well, right? Then
It's like, you know, there's like this, there's all these.
If you can afford a car.
There's all these like tried and true cliches that automotive journalists and consumer advocates tell
it's
people.
It's the truth.
Like here's another good one. Always get a pre-purchase inspection. And who the heck does that? Okay, you're selling a car, right? And let's say it's some good car that's got a major problem. You know, the second I go to you and I say, hey, can I take it for a pre-purchase inspection? Then I'm going to use whatever's wrong with it to hit you over the head to get the price to come down. That's how most people work, right? So why would you allow me to do a pre-purchase inspection?
Because that person is more likely to buy the car.
Really?
I think so.
They're more likely to pay you, 20% below the asking price.
Pre-purchase inspection aside, this is the one thing that Europe has right. And I'm not into crazy road rules. I think that there should be some freedom to that. But they kind of have this mentality that if you can afford to drive a car, you should be able to afford the safety that comes with snow tires. So in Germany right now, from like October to May, you can't drive a car in all seasons legally. You'd get pulled over and get a huge ticket and probably get your car towed. You have to be on snow tires. That is the performance difference between all seasons. And I know it's expensive, and I know it's a pain in the butt, and it's $1,100 you don't want to spend. But it's $1,100 to protect your $50,000 investment or your $60,000 investment. I mean, that's a lot of money you're saving.
Well, first of all, a lot of people don't have – snow tires are expensive.
So this lady that
they're very expensive.
But Dad, this lady that crashed into a tree
– And the other thing about snow tires, good snow tires
– Yep.
Is they will melt when it gets above 40 degrees.
You have to change them.
Yeah, and that's also
it's a pain. But Dad, once again, that's in my mind. If you live in a snowy climate, that should be.
How about if you live in California and you're driving to visit your aunt in Chicago in February?
It's a problem. I agree.
Yeah. So then in Germany, you have to have snow tires.
Yeah, but Dad, ultimately,
and Germany doesn't have any California like beaches, right? That whole country.
Yeah, but the EU. If I want to go to the Baltics and I'm going through Germany. I have to
go snow tires. I'm not disagreeing with you. I think snow tires are wonderful, but it's also in our country, the way we live is just not a practical solution for many people. For the people it is affordable, it's still not practical.
If you have a car.
That's why those all weathers are so good.
If you own a registered car in Colorado, you have to have a 3-peak snow rated tire. I think that should be a rule.
And then let's talk about that, right? So we just did a tire test. Tell them what happened with our AT 3-peak rated tire test. Tell them what happened. We had three tires. We had a Firestone. We had the
a good point.
KO3, and we had the Falcon.
Yeah, we had Falcons, the Wild Peak AT4W, the Firestone, Destination XT, I think, and then the BF Goodrich KO3. All 3-peak snow rated. All 3-peak snow rated. All terrains, and the Falcons did really badly. They were all the same load rating, and they were all the same size, and they were all on essentially the same wheel. And the braking performance on the Falcons was just unacceptable. It was very, very, very bad.
It was what?
You're right.
It was like twice as far.
And
the reason for that is because these ratings that these tire manufacturers put on their vehicles are done by there's no oversight as to what the standard must be. It's just the manufacturers association getting together and saying 3-peak snow rated tire means that it can accelerate from 0 to 50. Under very certain conditions in the snow, right? Not on ice, not on deep snow, but under kind of sludgy conditions in this amount of time.
It's not.
And so a lot of that is just marketing.
And you're right. It's not even a snow test. They actually have a specially designed full-size truck with the test tire mounted underneath it, as I understand it. And then they look at the traction variables for acceleration. Look, I agree. And I think I am oversimplifying it. And I'm also, keep in mind, that there's a lot of people that can't afford snow tires. And I don't want to exclude those people from having the ability to drive an automobile. But at the same time, I mean, these are life-saving pieces of technology, right? That lady that crashed behind me, if she had snow tires, she would have easily been able to stop in this situation. And that bumper that she tore off her new Santa Fe, she also crunched the adaptive cruise unit and the whole thing. I mean, that's going to be a $2,500 fix.
It's because somebody didn't blow a yellow light.
But Dad, it was not blowing a yellow light. It was blowing a red light. I mean, Morgan said that if I had blown it, I would have been blowing a red light. It was a really, really light yellow.
Okay.
So I think you're right. I probably am at fault there to some extent.
Look at the distance. Now we're looking at the for all of you guys who are watching this, the Wild Peak AT4W took 177 feet to stop versus 85 for the KO3 versus 90 for the Firestone.
Yeah, and I want to do some more testing with those tires because we had those tires on a G-Wagon too.
Yeah, and we got stuck.
Also horrible. The snow performance, the 3W was great, and the 4W in two different applications I've tried it, two different tires, sets of tires, really poor.
Yeah, but my point is a lot of those ratings that the manufacturers put on their tires is driven more as a marketing exercise than as a real consumer benefit.
And on the BFG, on the all-terrain tire thing, I think you're right. But when you get to Blizzaks, when you get to the Nokian snow tires.
I'm not saying the snow tires don't work.
They're amazing.
They're like night and day. I agree. All right, so in the last few minutes that we have left, why don't we each pick some of the best and worst cars for snowy Colorado conditions. It's been a very tough snow year for the entire country.
Yeah.
So I would go with any car. And trucks are good in the snow, but they do have that issue even with four-wheel drive where there's not a lot of weight over the back. So sure. I would go with any SUV that has a traditional low range with at least 10 inches of ground clearance. So I'm talking about Wranglers, Broncos, Defenders. I think all of these cars are kind of the ultimate in terms of ski cars. Now, if you want to go a step down from there, then I would talk about like all-wheel drive cars that maybe don't have a low range, but that do have extra ground clearance and come from the factory with at least somewhat snow-rated tires. So now we're talking about like Volvo Cross Countries. We're talking about, Honda's new set of more off-roady vehicles. So basically, the more off-roady it is, chances are the better it's going to be in the snow. That's just a general rule of thumb that I would go with. Let's hear you.
I would take it a step further. I mean,
I would avoid electric cars. I just don't like them in the snow.
Disagree. Okay. I think you got to take tires out of the equation.
Right. Of course.
You have to. Let's assume that all the cars we're talking about are running a dedicated snow tire.
Take the worst car on this list and put in a snow tire. It'll be the best car on this list.
So the reason I think that Broncos and Wranglers and 4Runners can be amazing in the snow, the reason I don't think they're the best in the snow, especially for the typical driver, is because when you put them in 4High, they crab and the handling gets a little weird. And that really freaks some people out. And then you end up with my mom's situation, who then she forgot to put her 4Runner into four-wheel drive, and she almost spun up on a met and passed.
Right, so caveat, get a 4Runner or any vehicle that has a dialable, selectable all-wheel drive, and you don't have to switch from too high to too low.
So, yeah, that's a good solution.
Yeah, 4High and 4Low.
Nope, too high to 4High.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so
4Auto, basically.
Yeah, you want 4Auto. In a truck, too. Same thing with a truck.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this new crop, in my opinion, the best snow cars out there are this new crop of full-time, all-wheel drive, rugged crossovers. So, for example, Honda Pilot Trail Sport, Honda Passport Trail Sport, rugged crossover with a dual-clutch rear diff that can actively vector torque. Yeah. Incredible. Yeah. Amazing.
It's actually much better than you think.
My hot take is because of that the rear diff in the Bronco Sport, like Badlands, and now the upcoming Sasquatch, I think it's better than the full-size Bronco in the snow.
Now, some of you may be wondering, what about Subaru's symmetric all-wheel drive? Well, they don't loan us cars, so we can't recommend them.
I've not driven the newer ones in the snow. I've had a Forester on the slip test. Wilderness that did really well. And then we had our video for Ian's Crosstrek in the snow. Also did pretty well. The problem is people think that it is dramatically better than the competition, and what Hyundai and Kia and Chevrolet are doing, not dramatically better. It seems to be right on par with some of the more modern systems. I think that the...
I don't know, Tommy. I haven't driven really any Subarus in the snow to compare, so I can't speak to that.
The Audi systems are interesting, and they used to be very based on model because, and not just Audi, but a lot of OEMs use a system of all-wheel drive called Haldex, which is a slip-then-grip system. So the front wheels slip.
In essence, power to the rear wheels.
And like on your old Volvo,
right.
The result of that is you get a lot of front wheels slip, and then it would punch you in the butt when the rear wheels engaged. But the new ones are so fast and so immediate that I don't really think Halidex anymore is a detriment. Like in the Golf R, it's freaking amazing. But yeah, any vehicle...
I don't think the Golf R is good. It doesn't have enough ground clearance.
Okay, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a car that actually has less ground clearance because it's a sporty car.
I mean, my favorite cars in the snow are any typically four-wheel drive that has a center differential and a full-time system, meaning it has no option for two-wheel drive.
Yeah.
So I'm talking Land Rover Defender, right? I'm talking Toyota Land Cruiser, Lexus GX, Lexus LX, right? Where they actually have a center differential. instead of a traditional transfer case, that means the car is always in four-wheel drive of some kind. That is my favorite kind of snow performance.
Yeah, and then also weight is important. The more weight, the harder it is to stop, right? The more physics of it are just that, and that is the heavier a vehicle, the longer it will take for it to stop, and the more likely you are to run into a little tree.
And then I know you disagree, but I do think the majority of these new crossovers with all-wheel drive, if it has over 6 inches of ground clearance, very capable with the right tires.
So you're talking about the most popular cars in America are the RAV4 and the CR-V.
No, I'm talking EVs. I'm talking like Model Y, Ioniq 5, ID4. With the right tires, I think they're fine. I've actually had really good experience. Like
I think they're fine until it gets really sketch.
Yeah, but like I drove an EQS, a rear wheel drive EQS on snow tires through the mountains. And it was terrifying because someone put water in the windshield washer fluid and they couldn't see. Yeah. But the actual capability of the car.
Stop that. Just stop it. At some point, you're going to want to drive to visit grandma in Chicago and you're going to hit the mountains and you're going to be in really bad shape.
My 1980s S-Class has a heated washer nozzle.
Yeah, that was very popular. Cool. Winter package.
So that actually was really good. So I don't think it's fair to say all EVs are bad in the snow.
No, I just said in general, I don't like EVs in the snow.
Okay.
Because of the range degradation, because of the weight, the other thing, another good rule of thumb is any car that is very fuel efficient tends to not be great in the snow because all of a sudden you're losing road clearance, right? So they tend to be much lower because the taller a car is, the worse it is aerodynamically. So fuel-efficient cars that are kind of meant to be economical tend to not be great in the snow. That's just my rule of thumb. Unless you can tell me, like give me a car like a Prius that is good in the snow.
The new Prius is pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you driven in the snow?
Yeah, they really upped the power in that rear motor. Okay. So you run into ground clearance issues, but
it doesn't have a drive shaft. It's got that electric motor in the back.
But they went from like 4 to like 7 horsepower in the back. Like 50 something. So they gave it a pretty big boost. That's actually pretty good.
And I would say, and this is going to go against my weight rule, I just love trucks in the snow. They feel...
But you just said that they're unpredictable and heavy.
The thing about trucks is they feel unstoppable until they're not. Right? Because
so then they're not good in the snow.
Well, no. So
they are good until they're not.
Any car is good until it's not. Like that Volvo with studded snow tires was good until it wasn't. But the thing about trucks is, in general, they tend to have more aggressive tires, which I think tend to be better in the snow. Out of the box. And most people drive on those. They tend to have more ground clearance. They tend to be four-wheel drive. But the problem with trucks, and I've made this mistake a lot, is you get up there, you're sitting up tall, which makes you feel like you own the world, right?
Yeah, you get overconfident.
And then you got all this big metal around you, and then... what happened to me in our first Raptor is I got it so freaking stuck in the snow because the other problem is once you get something heavy stuck in the snow, it's really hard to get out. Really hard to get out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like the things that make it better in the snow make it much worse to then pull out.
Yeah. I mean, I think that.
And you're right. Dedicated snow tires, you know,
is
there's nothing more safe, more rewarding than driving a car on. Oh, well, there is. Dedicated studded snow tires like Volvo had. Because those things are amazing, Tommy.
Bridgestone is claiming now that their new technology is actually more effective in snow than an old studded snow tire.
How about on the ice?
Definitely not on the ice.
Because that's what we were on, right?
Yeah. Ice. But in snow, they claim that.
So we were 400 kilometers above the Arctic Circle, and it's not... Snow driving, it's all ice all the time.
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
The roads just get polished slick, and I would love to just compare a studded.
I would like to too. And I think that if you live there, a studs must. But if you live in Boulder, Colorado, first of all, I'm not sure they're allowed in Colorado. Some states ban studded.
They are allowed in Colorado. They're just really the other problem is people don't take them off, and then it's just like my friend Willie.
Ran studded
snow tires on his Saabs, and then never took them off for the summer, and then it's like you're rolling down the road in the summer. And, you know, like you're tumbling rocks.
And even like, let's be honest, even in Colorado, 8 out of 10 days, it's not snowing in the winter.
Right.
So you're driving around a dry with a studded tire and it's not great.
All right. Well, let's wrap this up. If you guys own a Jimny in America, let us know. We'd love to test one. It's kind of my dream forbidden fruit truck.
You could go buy one in Japan. They're like 12 grand and ship it over.
18.
Or 18 grand.
Yeah, they're 18.
Even for the K version?
No, those are 12.
Yeah.
The regular ones are like 18.
Get a K version and ship it over.
For a year, and then you got to ship it back.
Yep, that's right.
And that's an expensive thing to do.
It is an expensive
and
thing.
And then you got to title it, and you have to insure it, and you have to license it in Japan.
Yes. It's not easy, but no. It is possible.
Easy.
Yeah.
All right, and thanks for watching, guys. And where should they head, Tommy, if they want to see more videos?
AllTFL.com is where everything is can be found. And thank you for watching. This has been a fun one.
Yeah, we'll see you next time. Ciao.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.